illicit drug traffic. Belli took Ruby's case and kept any mention of Ruby's mafia contacts out of the trial. Instead of using the sudden passion defense available in Texas, which can result in a sentence as short as 2 years served or even just probation, Belli used a bizarre psychomotor defense that had never been attempted before, and they lost. Jack Ruby received his death sentence in Dallas on March 14, 1964. Even while Ruby's trial was going on and after it ended, several Warren Commission staff members tried to do a thorough investigation of Jack Ruby's mafia ties and Cuban gun running, but they were stymied. The FBI intimidated several witnesses who tried to talk about Ruby's gun running, while FBI agents relied on Ruby's mob associates to say that Ruby had no mob associates. After the two staffers investigating Ruby wrote a long memo to the commission's general counsel outlining numerous problems and stonewalling by the FBI and by Richard Helms, they were barred from interviewing Ruby in Dallas. The resulting interview by Earl Warren and Gerald Ford was marked by Ruby saying, "Unless you get me to Washington, you can't get a fair shake out of me." Anthony Summers writes that repeatedly, 8 times in all, Ruby begged the Chief Justice of the U.S. to arrange for his transfer to Washington for further questioning and lie detector tests. Warren and Ford refused, even when Ruby pleaded with them, saying, "Gentlemen, my life is in danger." Given Sheriff Decker's mob ties and Marcello's control of Dallas, Ruby's concerns were all too real. The Warren Commission staff lost another important source of information when mob associates of Traficantes and Rosselli's framed Chicago Secret Service agent Abraham Bolden. Using information provided by two criminals he'd put in jail, Bolden was arrested on the day he went to Washington to tell Commission staff about the Secret Service's laxity, as well as the Chicago and Tampa attempts. One of Bolden's accusers worked for Sam DiStefano, a notorious associate of Richard Kane, the chief investigator for the Cook County, Chicago Sheriff's Office. Richard Kane's brother, Michael, told me that Richard Kane had the motive, means, and opportunity to frame Bolden. Kane was part of the Chicago Mafia and had worked with Rosselli and Traficante on the CIA Mafia plots. Bolden was sentenced to 6 years in prison, even though his main accuser later admitted to committing perjury against him. Bolden's judge told the jury before their deliberations that Bolden was guilty. But even after that misconduct resulted in a mistrial, the same judge was allowed to conduct Bolden's second trial. The result was another conviction, and Bolden has been fighting to clear his name ever since his release from prison. Some of the many shortcomings of the Warren Commission were covered in Chapters 1 and 2. They are too numerous to cover here, though Professor Gerald McKnight's Breach of Trust, 2005, details the most definitive account of their many problems. Basically, the Commission was not given much crucial information and had to rely on the FBI for most of their investigative work. Like the CIA, the Bureau withheld much crucial information from the Commission, including the Tampa attempt, and much about Cuban exiles tied to Traficante and Rosselli. Instead, the FBI flooded the Commission staff with reports of wild allegations and irrelevant paperwork. That's why you'll find Jack Ruby's mother's dental records in the 26 volumes of supporting evidence for the one-volume Warren Report, but nothing about the JFK Almeida coup plan, the CIA mafia plots, or the threat against JFK by Marcello and Traficante that informants reported to the FBI in 1962. Like Marcello, neither David Ferry nor Guy Bannister, who died of natural causes on June 6, 1964, is mentioned even once in the Warren Report. I noted in early chapters the Commission's internal struggles over their conclusion, but another problem surfaced just as the Commission had hoped to be wrapping up. Commission staffers and the FBI were under pressure to resolve the matter of Silvio Odio's visit from Oswald and two exiles a couple of months prior to JFK's murder. On September 16, 1964, the FBI apparently got a break. An anti-Castro soldier of fortune named Loren Hall allegedly told the FBI that he and two friends were the people who visited Silvia Odio. The soldier of fortune knew Santo Traficante and had been under house arrest with the mob boss in Cuba in 1959, before being asked to join the CIA mafia plots to kill Castro in the spring of 1963. Hall's convenient claim came just in time for the Warren Commission's last meeting, 2 days later. At that final meeting, three of the commission members, led by Georgia Senator Richard Russell, tried to include a dissenting opinion about the magic bullet theory. However, the effort failed, and the report was issued with no dissent. Over the next 2 days, Hall changed his story and denied having visited Odio, as did his two friends, but it was too late to change the commission's final report. The report was submitted to President Johnson on September 24, given to Hoover the following day, and released to the public on September 28, 1964. The press widely proclaimed the Warren Report, as it came to be known, to be the definitive account of Oswald's guilt as a lone assassin. In addition to his anti-Castro duties, E. Howard Hunt later admitted that during the 1960s, one of his duties for the CIA had been press and publisher relations. Both Richard Helms and his protege Hunt played behind-the-scenes roles with the press and publishers during 1964 and afterward, and that likely applied to the reporting of matters relating to the CIA, Cuban exiles, and JFK's assassination. Hunt later wrote that the Church Committee identified me as an important figure in the CIA's press operation, pointing out that one of my ongoing responsibilities was to get certain books reviewed by particular writers who would be either sympathetic or hostile to works we hoped to popularize or suppress. Hunt admitted that most of my work involved publishing and publications in which we supported an entire division of one publisher and subsidized books that we felt the American public should read. Hunt acknowledges that the CIA also ran a couple of national newswire services. The author of two early books about JFK's assassination, Thomas Buchanan and Joachim Joosten, a left-wing European journalist and concentration camp survivor, were the targets of CIA attempts to discredit them. The CIA even dug up Nazi files to use against Joosten, foreshadowing the more extensive efforts Helms and the CIA would launch against Warren Report critics just 2 years later. After the first wave of well-researched, best-selling books critical of the Warren Commission emerged in 1966, early the following year, the CIA issued a 53-page memo detailing how CIA officials could attack critics and bolster the lone nut theory in the press. In the 1970s, the Senate Church Committee was able to document that the CIA maintained covert relationships with about 50 American journalists or employees of U.S. media organizations from the 1960s to the mid-1970s. However, Carl Bernstein, in a major piece for Rolling Stone, was able to document there were actually 400 journalists who maintained covert relationships with the agency. Bernstein wrote that even that figure refers only to those who were tasked in their undercover assignments or had a mutual understanding that they would help the agency or were subject to some form of CIA contractual control. It does not include even larger numbers of journalists who occasionally traded favors with CIA officers in the normal give and take that exists between reporters and their sources. In E. Howard Hunt's final autobiography, he confirmed Bernstein's much higher figures and the other information in his article. In the mid-1960s, Hunt and his assistant Bernard Barker was still involved with the Manuel Artime side of the CIA mafia plots, which had now been officially merged with the Rolando Kubela assassination operation. RFK's liberal exile leader Manolo Rey was no longer working with the CIA, and Eloy Menoyo had been captured while on a mission into Cuba and had been given a life sentence. However, the CIA started getting reports from Traficante associates showing that the Kubela operation was insecure. In addition to the mob-linked security breaches surrounding the Cubela operation, Fidel Castro's intelligence agents had actually penetrated Artime's group a year earlier. Richard Helms was no doubt livid when he saw a January 25, 1965 article in The Nation that gave an all-too-accurate description of the extensive scope of Artime's operation. That publicity, various problems with Artime, and the insecurity of Cubela's operation due to Traficante's associates proved too much for Helms, and he began the gradual process of shutting down Artime's operation. Harry Williams had one last encounter with his former colleague, Manuel Artime, after Artime's CIA-backed operations had been ended, in part because of financial irregularities. In Miami, Williams happened to drop by a friend's house and was surprised to find Artime, Hunt, and Barker there, along with the Traficante associate. Williams told me they were planning the selling of the equipment for Artime. He advised them not to, and after declining their offer to join their venture, he quickly left. Instead, Artime, Hunt, and Barker sold the supplies and apparently kept the money. On February 28, 1966, Rolando Cubela, AMLASH, was arrested in Cuba, due in part to information from Fidel's agent in Artime's camp. Two CIA cables in the following weeks mentioned or alluded to Almeida, with one expressing relief that none of the real military leaders in Cuba had been arrested or detained. When the New York Times reported on March 6, 1966, that Cubela planned to shoot Premier Castro with a high-powered telescopic rifle and later share power with Mr. Artime, LBJ's Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, asked Richard Helms if that was true. Helms lied to him, saying the agency was not involved with Cubela in a plot to assassinate Fidel Castro, nor did it ever encourage him to attempt such an act. Richard Helms officially became CIA director on June 30, 1966, putting him in an even stronger position to ensure that his unauthorized activities under JFK and LBJ were not exposed. In addition to firing Bernard Barker, Helms made sure that six CIA veterans of AmWorld and his sensitive anti-Castro operations were reassigned to Laos in 1966, where the United States had been waging a secret war for years. These included Artime's deputy Rafael Chichi Quintero, former Miami CIA chief Ted Shackley, and David Morales, after an assignment in South America involving the capture of Che Guevara. 1966 brought a wave of new challenges for Carlos Marcello and his associates, in addition to the spate of best-selling books critical of the Warren Report, though all of them avoided any mention of the Mafia. In May 1966, Sam Giancana left the country after using his work on the CIA Mafia plots to avoid spending another year in jail for refusing to testify about the Mafia to a grand jury after being granted immunity. His old pal Johnny Rosselli was not so lucky when the FBI got a tip that his real name was Filippo Sacco and he wasn't a U.S. citizen. William Harvey tried to get the CIA to aid Rosselli, but to no avail, and Harvey was forced to resign from the CIA the following year. Apparently, the younger FBI agents in New Orleans had grown tired of seeing Marcello literally get away with murder. After Marcello went to a mafia summit in New York that included Traficante and attorney Frank Regano, Marcello returned to New Orleans on October 1, 1966. Apparently, hoping to force Hoover to take action against Marcello, an FBI agent staged a public confrontation with the Godfather at the airport. Accounts vary as to the reasons for what happened next, but the physical act was well documented by witnesses and a photographer. Marcello took a swing at the FBI agent and hit him. The resulting arrest and charges would dog Marcello for years, eventually sending him to a short stay in federal prison. Marcello and Traficante was dealt another blow on October 5, 1966, when the Texas Court of Appeals ordered a new trial for Jack Ruby. 2 months later, the same court would order a change of venue to Wichita Falls, Texas, away from Dallas and its mob-affiliated sheriff. 3 days after winning that appeal, Ruby was diagnosed with cancer and died on January 3, 1967, before his trial could begin. In November 1966, the New York Times was one of several major American newspapers and magazines investigating the JFK assassination anew. The Times wrote to a New Orleans police lieutenant listing 32 questions about the assassination, primarily focused on David Ferry, but also including Carlos Marcello. The police chief gave a copy of the letter to New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison, who then had Ferry brought in for questioning in December 1966. Garrison tried to conduct his investigation in secret at first, but it was leaked to the media, resulting in a firestorm of publicity that centered on Ferry. At the height of the controversy, on February 22, 1967, David Ferry died, an apparent suicide. That same night, Ferry's friend, Eladio Del Valle, an associate of Traficante and Masferrer, was murdered in Florida. In the weeks and months that followed, Garrison's investigation was targeted by a variety of people offering to help, some of whom should have been investigated themselves, such as a bitter Cuban exile named Alberto Fowler and Traficante associates Rolando Masferrer and Lauren Hall. After Ferry's death, Garrison focused on Clay Shaw, a co-worker of Fowler. RFK asked his close associate Walter Sheridan to go to New Orleans and look into Garrison's charges. However, Sheridan felt that Garrison was a fraud, and he soon began to undermine Garrison's investigation in various ways, which included producing an NBC News special critical of Garrison. Recently released FBI files show that in the late spring of 1967, Garrison twice privately considered indicting Marcello for the assassination of JFK, but decided not to. Instead, Garrison's investigation wound up becoming a media circus, and Clay Shaw was eventually acquitted. In 1967, amid the Garrison firestorm, to pressure the CIA to help him, Johnny Rosselli began leaking information to columnist Jack Anderson, who was not yet the journalist superstar he would become before the Watergate scandal 5 years later. Rosselli's leaks to Anderson hinted at the CIA mafia plots, though the mafia don attempted to tie them to Robert Kennedy. No other reporters followed up on Anderson's stories, but President Johnson asked CIA Director Richard Helms for a report on the plots and any links they might have had to JFK's assassination. Helms met with RFK around this time, and the resulting Inspector General's report delivered by Helms contained no information about the JFK Almeida coup plan or AmWorld, Rosselli's work for the CIA in the summer and fall of 1963, or the 1959 CIA mafia plots involving Jimmy Hoffa. In July 1967, CIA official Desmond Fitzgerald, who had overseen the CIA mafia plots in 1963, died of natural causes. Carlos Marcello would increasingly become the focus of unwanted attention in 1967 and the first half of 1968. On May 6, 1967, author Ed Reed showed a copy of the manuscript for his new book to the Los Angeles FBI Bureau. It mentioned, for the first time, Marcello's fall 1962 assassination threat against JFK, heard by Ed Becker. Someone high in the Los Angeles mob learned about Reed's manuscript because the very next day the mafia's most powerful attorney, Sidney Korshak, provided the FBI with derogatory information about Becker. Early in 1968, Senator Robert Kennedy began offering behind-the-scenes help to journalist Michael Dorman for an article about Carlos Marcello. According to one account, Dorman received RFK's personal attention, meeting with the senator in his office. Dorman told author Gus Russo that Robert Kennedy was enthusiastic about the article, and even offered to have one of his aides assist Dorman. In March 1968, Robert Kennedy officially entered the race for the presidency. Just as his late-starting campaign was building impressive momentum by winning the all-important California primary, he was tragically assassinated on June 4, 1968. His convicted assailant, Sirhan Bishara Sirhan, was first represented by Johnny Roselli's Los Angeles attorney, whose defense strategy included admitting in court that Sirhan had fired the fatal headshot, a claim some experts still contest today. Sirhan's co-counsel was a lawyer whom David Scheim writes had represented many mob clients and had once been investigated himself by Robert Kennedy. Years later, Robert Kennedy's friend and biographer Jack Newfield wrote that Joe Marcello, Carlos's younger brother, made this remark about the Kennedys to FBI informant Joe Hauser: "We took care of them, didn't we?" In the early 1970s, the 59-year-old Carlos Marcello was continuing to expand his criminal empire, even as he diversified into more legitimate businesses. Marcello still ordered contract killings, even while appealing his assault conviction and 2-year sentence for slugging an FBI agent. Mississippi's Sun Herald reported that in just the first 2 months of 1970, Marcello's hits included the murders of Jack Howard Joy and Donald Lester Jimmy James, and as usual for Marcello, no one was ever convicted of either murder. Marcello was under pressure because he'd been convicted of assaulting the FBI agent, and his appeals were running out. However, Marcello had backed Nixon for years, and one of Marcello's fixers was close to President Nixon's own fixer, former mob attorney Murray Schottener. According to John H. Davis, Marcello and his lawyers pulled every string at their command to get Carlos's 2-year sentence reduced to 6 months, and made arrangements for him to spend that time at the Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Springfield, Missouri. That was in stark contrast to his old friend Jimmy Hoffa, who was doing hard time at the Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary. Marcello entered the Springfield facility on October 14, 1970. Since it was one of the least secure and most comfortable federal prisons, allowing more phone calls and visitors than others, Marcello had no trouble running his empire from prison. When he was released on March 12, 1971, after serving just 5 months, Marcello emerged much healthier and more fit, ready for what would be his most prosperous decade. Even before Marcello entered prison in 1970, reporters whispered among themselves that the New Orleans Godfather was tied to JFK's murder. Television journalist Peter Noyes recalls covering a Marcello court appearance in 1970 when a newspaper reporter told him, "There's been a lot of talk about that guy being involved in the Kennedy assassination." In fall 1971, Noyes learned from the Los Angeles Chief Deputy District Attorney that the Senate Judiciary Committee was holding secret meetings into the assassinations of John and Robert Kennedy. These were prompted by California Senator George Murphy's speech, in which he said the killers of John and Robert Kennedy may have acted under orders from someone else. An aide to Murphy confirmed the secret hearings to Noyes, who began writing a book about the assassinations, Legacy of Doubt. At 65, Johnny Roselli was facing 5 years in prison after being caught and convicted for his Friars Club cheating scheme and immigration violations. The INS was also again trying to deport him. A CIA memo says that on November 18, 1970, Mr. Helms flatly refused to intercede with INS on Roselli's behalf. However, the CIA admits meeting with INS regarding the status of the deportation proceedings in March 1971, and the INS deportation efforts were halted at that time after Roselli entered prison on February 25, 1971. Roselli had forced Helms to intervene by resuming his leaks to muckraking columnist Jack Anderson. On January 18, 1971, Anderson ran the first of 2 new articles about the CIA mafia plots, asking, again, could the plot against Castro have backfired against President Kennedy? The new articles discussed 6 CIA attempts against Cuba's Fidel Castro, including those involving rifles. Anderson said the Castro assassination plot he was writing about began as part of the Bay of Pigs operation to eliminate the Cuban dictator before the motley invaders landed. Anderson's linking the Bay of Pigs and the CIA mafia plots to JFK's assassination would hit President Nixon especially hard, since it referred to events during his tenure as vice president. Nixon's alarm at the time was confirmed by long-secret Senate Watergate committee files that I published for the first time in 2012. Nixon's Attorney General John Mitchell, also Nixon's de facto campaign manager, was reportedly in tears after talking with former Howard Hughes aide Robert Mayhew about the plots. In addition, Jack Anderson wrote that the plots continued until March 1963, and for the first time named some of the participants, Rosselli, Harvey, and Mayhew. However, Anderson's column didn't mention Traficante, Giancana, Marcello, or David Morales, meaning that someone as knowledgeable as Helms would realize Rosselli had more bombshells to drop if he chose. Soon after the Rosselli-Anderson articles, E. Howard Hunt began working as a White House consultant. The conventional wisdom is that Nixon formed the Plumbers with Hunt to plug leaks like those of Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. However, Hunt began working for Nixon and recruiting former colleagues like Bernard Barker in mid-April 1971, before the Pentagon Papers were first published. Clearly, as a veteran of the CIA mafia plots that Nixon had begun back in 1960, Hunt's first priority was to make sure that Nixon's role in those plots didn't surface. Testimony shows that Hunt was even ordered by the White House to look into assassinating Jack Anderson. Later in 1971, CIA official David Atlee Phillips was apparently overseeing a new assassination attempt against Fidel Castro, once more involving Cuban exile Antonio Veciana. The site was Chile, which had a new socialist government. The attempt failed, but Fidel was apparently so angry that he ordered the compilation of a huge dossier of the CIA's attempts to kill him. The dossier, with extensive details, including photos of captured weapons and assassins, began when Nixon was vice president in 1960 and continued under Nixon's presidency. As the new Senate Watergate files indicate, and Watergate burglar Frank Fiorini confirmed in a long-overlooked published interview, the Watergate break-ins were all about trying to see if that dossier had fallen into the hands of Nixon's enemies. The first break-in, involving Hunt, Barker, Fiorini, using the name Frank Sturgis, and the other Plumbers, occurred at the Chilean embassy in Washington. That burglary, which Nixon talked about on a White House tape, occurred 2 weeks before the first Watergate break-in. As Traficante later revealed to the chief investigator for his attorney, that's also why almost all of the Watergate burglars were veterans of the CIA mafia plots. Remarkably, 6 months before the first Watergate break-in, President Nixon had received a new mafia bribe of $1 million involving Jimmy Hoffa. Just as in 1960, this new Mafia Hoffa bribe again involved Carlos Marcello, Santo Traficante, and New Jersey mobster Tony Provenzano. As documented by the FBI and Time magazine, the bribe was for Hoffa's release from prison, only with the condition that he couldn't return to the Teamsters for 8 years. The mob bosses preferred to deal with Hoffa's easygoing replacement, Frank Fitzsimmons, instead of the volatile Hoffa, hence the special stipulation barring Hoffa from the Teamsters. In late 1973, Hoffa, angry that Nixon had kept him from the Teamsters, tipped Senate Watergate Committee investigators about Nixon, Johnny Rosselli, and the CIA mafia plots. Committee investigators interviewed Johnny Rosselli in a secret session about those plots. However, for reasons that are still unclear, that part of the investigation was shut down in early 1974 and was withheld from the press. However, following Nixon's resignation in August 1974, leaks about assassinations coming from new President Gerald Ford resulted in news articles that caused Ford to create the Rockefeller Commission on January 4, 1975, to investigate CIA activities, including assassination plots and JFK's assassination. However, the Rockefeller Commission was stacked with conservative establishment figures like Ronald Reagan, so Congress created their own investigating committees, the Pike Committee, originally the NEDZI Committee, and the far better known Church Committee, named for Liberal Senator Frank Church of Idaho. Their goal was to investigate CIA operations, domestic surveillance, and assassination plots. In the case of each of those committees, all the files about the JFK Almeida coup plan and its infiltration by the mafia were withheld from Congress. That was ostensibly to protect Almeida, still a very high official in Cuba, from being exposed as a U.S. asset. It also prevented the exposure of intelligence failures by agencies like the CIA and potentially embarrassing revelations about officials of both parties. For example, while crucial information was being withheld from the Church Committee, former Warren Commission member Gerald Ford was president. His chief of staff was Donald Rumsfeld, his senior White House advisor, Dick Cheney, and later his CIA director was George H.W. Bush. All four men had been part of the Nixon administration during the Watergate scandal, which had involved numerous veterans of the anti-Castro plots, including those linked to the mafia. Of course, Marcello, Trafficante, and Rosselli had the most to fear if their roles in JFK's assassination were exposed by the congressional investigations. The Godfathers would try to prevent that at any cost, even if it meant murdering some of their own. Chapter 18. Mafia murders, confessions, and a million files still secret. The CIA mafia plots to kill Fidel Castro became front-page news in June 1975. Even as the Rockefeller Commission issued its final report on June 11, 1975, the Senate Church Committee intensified its efforts. On June 13, the Church Committee again grilled Helms, this time exclusively about CIA assassination plots, including those with the mafia. He testified in closed session, so the public had no way to know what he said or didn't say. Carlos Marcello and Santo Trafficante would have been extremely concerned, since Helms' revelations about the CIA mafia plots could lead to the exposure of their roles in JFK's murder. In the short term, Trafficante had the most to lose, since he'd played a much bigger role in the CIA mafia plots. Trafficante would have been especially worried when Sam Giancana was subpoenaed and slated to testify on June 26. On June 19, 1975, Sam Giancana became the first of several congressional witnesses to be murdered. The former mob boss was cooking a late-night meal for a trusted friend visiting his home in Chicago's Oak Park neighborhood. His friend shot Giancana 7 times with a silenced .22-caliber pistol, an unusually small gun for a mob hit. 5 of the shots were around Giancana's chin and mouth, a sign that mafiosi shouldn't talk. The gun was eventually traced to Florida, and some pointed the finger at Trafficante. One government informant, Charles Grimaldi, said that Giancana was killed by someone who worked for the CIA, though the hitman was acting on his own and not at the request of officials. Since several CIA assets and officials also worked with the mafia, the hitman could have been someone with ties to both the mob and the agency. Giancana's murder made headlines across the country, adding urgency to the committee's investigations. The day after Giancana's death, CIA Director William Colby testified about CIA assassination plots, followed 4 days later by Johnny Rosselli. The transcripts, kept secret until the 1990s, show that Rosselli had mastered the art of saying a lot while revealing little, sticking to an incomplete version of the CIA mafia plots that mirrored the whitewashed version Helms had promulgated in his own testimony and in the 1967 Inspector General's report. On June 25, William Harvey testified to the Church Committee about the CIA mafia plots, followed by more testimony from Helms on July 17 and 18, both in closed sessions. Jack Anderson wrote once more about Rosselli on July 7, and Time magazine ran an article touching on the original 1959 CIA mafia plots that Jimmy Hoffa had brokered, a story Hoffa himself had just leaked to someone with the Church Committee. Hoffa was now in the crosshairs of the committee because of Time's article about the 1959 CIA mafia plots. Carlos Marcello and Santo Traficante couldn't afford to let Hoffa testify, continue his leaks to committee staff, or continue his efforts to rejoin the Teamsters. According to the Camtex FBI file, Marcello summoned Hoffa to Churchill Farms for a conference shortly before his disappearance, but Hoffa refused to back down. On July 30, 1975, Jimmy Hoffa was spotted leaving a restaurant near Detroit, headed for what he thought was a meeting with New Jersey mobster Tony Provenzano, an associate of Carlos Marcello's. Hoffa was never seen again, and his body has never been found. Government informant Grimaldi said that he had heard information that the same man that killed Giancana took care of Hoffa for the same reason. He knew about the Castro plots, and it had been Hoffa who was the original liaison between the CIA and the mafia. Hoffa was killed the same day Senator George McGovern released to the U.S. news media an updated copy of the Cuban dossier of CIA assassination attempts against Castro, which McGovern had recently received in Cuba. Johnny Roselli used Jack Anderson to ensure he didn't meet the same fate as Giancana and Hoffa. Anderson's September 1, 1975 column claimed that Roselli had avoided deportation because of his war record, helping Roselli show Traficante and Marcello that he wasn't getting preferential INS treatment because he was testifying. Roselli was back in front of the church committee on September 22, 10 days after Helms had faced the committee yet again. Traficante's old associate Rolando Masferrer, who was on the fringe of the JFK plot, was killed in a spectacular car bombing on October 31, 1975. His death could have been related to the church committee hearings or to the general upsurge of violence in Miami's exile community, fueled by politics and the expanding drug trade. A current article about JFK's assassination was on Masferrer's desk when he died. John Martino, Masferrer's mutual associate with Traficante, had died of natural causes on August 3, 1975, 3 days after Hoffa disappeared. In declining health, Martino had finally confessed his role in JFK's murder to two friends, his business partner and reporter John Cummings. The church committee apparently never learned about Martino or his published statements about the Kennedys' 1963 coup and invasion plan. William Harvey, who had already testified to the church committee, but had not revealed all he knew about the CIA mafia plots, died on June 9, 1976. Long out of the CIA, he had worked most recently at a book publisher, where he reportedly scrubbed information about Johnny Roselli and the Miami CIA station from the memoir of an Army Ranger stationed there in 1963. It was restored for a later edition. In addition to the main Senate Church Committee, there was a subcommittee with Senators Gary Hart and Richard Schweiker that was devoted exclusively to exploring JFK's assassination. Their report was issued on June 23, 1976, but Schweiker was determined to forge ahead with the investigation, which included the possibility of more interrogation of Johnny Roselli by increasingly knowledgeable Senate staffers. Roselli had a problem he could have discussed only with his attorney, Tom Wadden. During intense questioning, he had reportedly given congressional investigators Santo Traficante's name in relation to JFK's assassination. Roselli had to explain to Wadden why that, or further testimony, was so dangerous. According to historian Richard Mahoney, Roselli confessed to Wadden his role in plotting to kill the president, something Wadden revealed only much later to RFK's former mafia prosecutor William Hundley. On July 16, 1976, Roselli had dinner with Traficante and told the Godfather he'd had to mention his name during his most recent testimony. 12 days later, on July 28, 1976, Roselli was seen alive in public for the last time. Once it was clear Roselli was missing, Senator Schweiker asked the FBI to look into the matter. Roselli's body finally turned up on August 7, 1976, in a 55-gallon oil drum found in a canal near Miami. Roselli had been shot and stabbed, his legs cut off, and his body stuffed in the oil drum. It was shot with holes so it wouldn't float, then weighted with chains. But somehow it was still discovered. The police were officially baffled, and E. Howard Hunt suggested that Fidel had killed Roselli. However, three of Roselli's associates said that Trafficante had ordered the gruesome slaying. Roselli's murder was the kind of headline news that even the most jaded or intimidated reporter couldn't ignore, especially after Jack Anderson revealed information he had to keep secret while Roselli was alive. In his September 7, 1976 column, Anderson wrote that Roselli had said those involved in the CIA mafia plots had killed JFK, and even hinted that shots from the grassy knoll were part of that plan. The Senate Church Committee hearings had overshadowed those in the House by the Pike Committee, but on September 17, 1976, amid the furor created by Roselli's murder, the House created the Select Committee on Assassinations. Unfortunately, the investigation's first 9 months were hampered by problems in settling on a chief counsel to direct the probe and determining which member of Congress would chair the committee. Not until the summer of 1977 did the House Select Committee finally have its permanent general counsel, G. Robert Blakey, creator of the RICO racketeering law and a former mafia prosecutor for Robert Kennedy. Santo Trafficante had been interviewed once by the Church Committee, with no record kept at Trafficante's request, but he couldn't count on such consideration from the new House Select Committee. Hitman Charles Nicoletti, an associate of Johnny Roselli's and a veteran of the CIA mafia plots with Trafficante, was slated to talk to congressional investigators. But on March 29, 1977, Nicoletti was the victim of a mob assassination in Chicago, according to the Miami Herald. They said Nicoletti was pulled from his burning car after being shot 3 times in the back of the head at point-blank range. The article mentioned that Nicoletti had once been responsible for drawing up CIA-ordered plans for the assassination of Castro in October 1963, though at that time Nicoletti's mob superiors were far more focused on assassinating JFK than Castro. Gaetan Fonzi, an investigator for the Church Committee, had gone to work for the new House Select Committee on Assassinations. On the same day that Nicoletti died, Fonzi was in South Florida to interview George de Morenschild, the sophisticated white Russian who had been Oswald's best friend for a time. De Morenschild had known not only Jackie Kennedy, but also George H.W. Bush. Even as Fonzi spoke to de Morenschild's daughter about arranging the interview, de Morenschild was meeting with a writer for the Wall Street Journal, Edward Epstein, telling Epstein he'd informed Dallas CIA official J. Walton Moore about Oswald's activities. That evening, before Fonzi could meet him, de Morenschild committed suicide by putting the barrel of a 20-gauge shotgun in his mouth and pulling the trigger. About a week later, Fonzi had also planned to set up an interview in Miami with former Cuban President Carlos Prio, also an associate of Trafficante's. On April 5, 1977, before Fonzi could interview him, Prio committed suicide by shooting himself in the heart with a .38 pistol. That fall, Fonzi tried to arrange an interview with Cuban exile Manuel Artime after being tipped that Artime had guilty knowledge of JFK's assassination. Artime, one of E. Howard Hunt's best friends and a supplier of hush money to Hunt and the other Watergate burglars, had become a player in Miami's exploding drug market. Fonzi's partner talked to Artime in early November about scheduling an interview, but Artime entered the hospital the following week, was diagnosed with cancer, and died 2 weeks later, on November 18, 1977, at only 45. The following spring, Fonzi tried to track down David Morales, though the CIA made it difficult for the House Select Committee to determine even Morales' CIA position in 1963. 2 weeks after David Atlee Phillips and Antonio Veciana testified to the Select Committee in executive session, and after Morales was added to the list of CIA personnel the committee wanted to interview, Morales died, apparently of natural causes, on May 8, 1978. In less than 3 years, congressional investigations had been thwarted by the deaths of at least 9 actual or potential witnesses, from the sensational murders of Rosselli, Giancana, and Hoffa, to the unexpected deaths of Morales, Artime, and de Morenschild. Those important witnesses died before they could testify fully or, in most cases, testify at all. Surprisingly, even after Harry Williams had seen those headlines, he still volunteered to talk to the House Select Committee, but he never heard back from them. The remaining problems for Fonzie, Blakey, and the rest of the committee centered on the CIA and the Mafia, as well as on critical files being withheld from them by the CIA, FBI, Secret Service, and Naval Intelligence, and Marine Intelligence. Richard Helms faced charges about lying to Congress that needed to be resolved before he could testify. After a major White House meeting about the issue in July 1977, Helms agreed to plead guilty to making a false statement to Congress and was fined $2,000 on November 4, 1977. Later that day, he went to a CIA reception where his current and former CIA colleagues donated an even larger amount. Santo Traficante had primarily pleaded the fifth in his first House Select Committee appearance on March 16, 1977, but Blakey arranged to grant him and Marcello limited immunity in an effort to get them to talk. The situation was complicated because Traficante was under indictment for charges relating to the FBI's Brilab investigation, which had grown out of the Watergate-era prosecution of Nixon's former Attorney General, Richard Kleindienst. Carlos Marcello didn't realize his new business partner, Joe Hauser, would soon be a wired FBI informant for that operation. Nonetheless, Traficante testified on November 14, 1977, and September 28, 1978, and Marcello testified in January 1978. Both gave cautious statements and denied having anything to do with JFK's murder. The same month that Traficante testified for the last time, author Dan Maldea had a revealing exchange with Frank Regano, Traficante's former attorney, who had gone through a very acrimonious split with the Tampa Godfather. Possibly as part of a Teamster effort to suppress Maldea's book, Regano had offered Maldea a large sum for the rights to it. As part of their back and forth in September 1978, Maldea had his attorney ask Regano about his book's theory that Hoffa, Marcello, and Traficante were behind JFK's murder. Maldea said that Regano corroborated my conclusions. Bernard Barker had been released from prison for his Watergate crimes in June 1974, but by 1978 he was being investigated by the House Select Committee on Assassinations. According to a formerly secret committee memorandum about Barker, he was closely examined under oath by the committee about allegations under investigation by the committee that Barker associates Hunt and Frank Sturgis, a.k.a. Fiorini, were in Dallas on November 22, 1963. We can't tell if the committee investigated Barker's possible presence in Dallas that day, because according to the National Archives website, Barker's entire committee testimony on August 29, 1978, remains withheld. That is highly unusual, since even the testimony of far more senior CIA figures like Richard Helms, E. Howard Hunt, and David Atlee Phillips has been released in full. For CIA figures, testimony can be released with any sensitive terms or identities censored. So it's remarkable that all of Barker's committee testimony remains secret. Even though the committee conducted an investigation of Barker, it's not mentioned in the committee's final report or in any of their supporting volumes. A 6-page committee memorandum about Barker, recently discovered among the million-plus pages of JFK files on the Mary Farrell Foundation website, is the only indication Barker was investigated by the committee. However, the memorandum's biography of Barker does not mention the FBI report of Barker's gangster activity in Cuba, which may not have been provided to the committee. There is no indication in the memo that the committee investigated Barker's mafia ties. The CIA withheld much material from the committee about the roles of Barker and Hunt and Helms in the JFK Almeida coup plan and the CIA mafia plots. A CIA Office of Security memo says that 3 sealed envelopes were deleted from the Barker file given to the committee. On April 22, 1978, Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, a veteran of the JFK Almeida coup plan, had his representative meet with Commander Juan Almeida at the UN in New York. A short time later, CIA officer George Ioannidis was assigned to be the agency's new liaison with the House Select Committee. Ioannidis had worked with David Attlee Phillips in 1963, running the DRE exile group involved in the altercation with Oswald. The committee wanted to interview the CIA agent running the DRE in 1963, but Ioannidis claimed he couldn't be found. It appears that some high CIA official, probably Ted Shackley, was using Ioannidis and the excuse of protecting Almeida to withhold important information from the committee. As the House Select Committee on Assassinations rushed to finish its work on the JFK assassination, acoustic tests indicated there had been at least one shot from the grassy knoll. Those highly technical findings have been the source of much debate ever since, so I have not factored them into my conclusions. When the House Committee submitted its final report on March 29, 1979, its ultimate conclusion about JFK's murder was that it was likely a conspiracy involving at least one shot from the grassy knoll. In addition, the committee found that Traficante, like Marcello, had the motive, means, and opportunity to assassinate President Kennedy. For both Marcello and Traficante, the committee was unable to establish direct evidence of Marcello's complicity. It could just as well have added, because of all the material the CIA, FBI, and other agencies withheld. Investigator Gaetan Fonzi later wrote a book-length account of all the agencies stonewalling the committee had faced, called The Last Investigation. The committee also recommended the Justice Department investigate the possible involvement of Marcello and Traficante in JFK's murder. By 1981, Carlos Marcello was feeling the full force of the FBI's Brilab undercover operation. Facing the biggest legal battle of his life, Marcello was under indictment in Louisiana for trying to bribe state officials in a multi-million-dollar insurance scam. In Los Angeles, he'd been indicted for trying to bribe a federal judge. Even worse, much of the evidence was in the Godfather's own words, recorded by a bug and phone taps the FBI had finally placed in Marcello's office at the Town and Country Motel. They were augmented by secret recordings made by convicted insurance swindler Joe Hauser, who wore a wire for the FBI in hopes of securing an early release. He was aided by 2 undercover FBI agents who pretended to be crooked businessmen. In Miami, Santo Traficante was under indictment for a $1 million labor union fraud scheme. Both Traficante and Marcello were also hit with RICO racketeering charges, using the statute that G. Robert Blakey had helped create. Traficante would avoid conviction, but Marcello's luck had finally run out. Marcello's Brilab battles were covered by the press in New Orleans and by some national media like the New York Times, but the coverage rarely mentioned his name in conjunction with JFK's assassination. The 1,200 hours of Brilab recordings, along with unrecorded information from Hauser, contained tantalizing hints about Marcello and the assassination. They weren't mentioned in the press and were barred from the trial at Marcello's lawyer's request, so they wouldn't prejudice the jury. Still, the jury was able to hear hours of Marcello discussing the blatant corruption and crimes he had been committing for years. Marcello was convicted in Louisiana on August 4, 1981, and in Los Angeles on December 11, 1981. The following year, he was sentenced to 7 years for the Louisiana counts and 10 years for the Los Angeles counts. His powerful attorneys did everything they could, but on April 15, 1983, Marcello's Brilab appeal was denied, and he was ordered to begin serving his sentence immediately. At age 73, Marcello faced 17 years in prison. He was initially sent to familiar territory, the U.S. Medical Center for Federal Prisoners in Springfield, Missouri, where Marcello had spent 6 months a decade earlier. The prison and its park-like grounds were designated as Level 1, meaning it was one of the least secure and most comfortable federal prisons. But after a year, Marcello was transferred to the far more secure federal prison in Texarkana, Texas, an imposing three-level facility where most prisoners had few comforts. However, Marcello was not like most other prisoners, and he soon found ways to receive extraordinary privileges. As detailed in Chapter 3, by December 1985, Jack Van Lanningham was Carlos Marcello's cellmate at Texarkana, as part of the FBI's highly secret Camtex undercover operation. Van Lanningham had placed a court-authorized bugged transistor radio in their cell, and the Bureau was recording everything the two said there. Supervising the operation was FBI agent Thomas Kimmel. Agent Tom Kirk worked undercover, pretending to be a sleazy businessman with a friend in the Bureau of Prisons who, for the right price, could get Marcello transferred to a nicer prison and eventually even released. While Carlos was in prison, his younger brother, Joe, ran the parts of Carlos's empire that the Godfather couldn't run from prison. Carlos Marcello had grown close to his trusted cellmate, Jack Van Lanningham, and it was on December 15, 1987, that FBI files confirmed that the Godfather made his dramatic confession to having ordered JFK's assassination to Van Lanningham and other witnesses. "Yeah, I had the son of a bitch killed. I'm glad I did. I'm sorry I couldn't have done it myself." That night, in their cell, Marcello said, "Jack, you can never mention to anybody that I had Kennedy killed." Van Lanningham tried to mollify the Godfather and reassured him his secret was safe, all while knowing the FBI was recording their conversation through the bugged transistor radio. Van Lanningham was even more nervous about his undercover role after Marcello's admission. Agent Kirk told him that they had heard Marcello's remarks in the cell and that it had even gone as far as the Attorney General. Van Lanningham offered to take a lie detector test about Marcello's admission, and he wanted to drop out of Camtex. But Agent Kirk convinced him to stay. Marcello's family had paid the first bribe, and the Godfather wanted Jack to be the first to go to the nicer Level 2 Segoville prison near Dallas, where Marcello would join him a few days later. Though Van Lanningham was still afraid, he also wanted to know more about what Marcello had done to JFK. The next time Marcello brought up the Kennedys and his deportation while they were in their cell, Jack encouraged him to talk about his hatred of the Kennedys. That resulted in Marcello's making a few more revelations about the assassination, including the two hitmen he imported from Europe, which were all recorded by the FBI's bugged radio. Van Lanningham said in his FBI file that on the 17th of December 1985, "I was packing to leave the next day for Segoville prison when Marcello told me to sit down, that he had something to talk to me about. He said we had become good friends and I want to tell you a story. He was dead serious and I was scared. He said a priest came to visit him from Italy years before. The priest was old mafia. 'My son,' he said, 'if your enemies get in your way, you bury them in the ground. The grass grows over them, and you go on about your business.' He was telling me that if I crossed him, the grass would grow over me, as I would be dead. My God, if he had murdered the president, he would have no trouble with me." After Marcello joined Van Lanningham at the Segoville prison, Joe Marcello was supposed to pay another bribe to have Marcello moved from Segoville to the federal facility at Fort Worth, which John H. Davis described as the paradise of the federal prison system, a minimum security level 1 facility. After the Godfather was moved to Fort Worth, a final bribe, $1 million, was to be paid to Kirk for Marcello's early release from prison. Van Lanningham said that Marcello was grateful for what Van Lanningham was doing and told him that after we were out, he was going to take me into his organization. Marcello complained to Van Lanningham about the running of his organization by his brother Joe Marcello, who lacked the ability to run such a huge criminal empire. Soon, Van Lanningham was transferred to a